So Shams outline series is what I used in high school, and we just worked just about every integral problem in Shams.
They have one for everything. Electromagnetics. The one for electromagnetics is pretty good.
I think it's actually up in the library in the student lounge.
They have one for signals and systems. It's pretty good.
Well.
And if nothing else, I shouldn't say these things, but you know, learning how to game your education is very important. Whenever you have a class that has take-home problems, you should go get the Shams book for that class, because there's a pretty high probability you're going to see those problems in Shams somewhere. Worked and explained.
That's crazy.
That's one of the reasons I don't like giving take-home exams, because a good student can find answers. Yeah. There's a finite number of electromagnetics problems you can ask.
A good student or a resourceful?
I don't know.
There's a good student or a resourceful student.
I consider resourceful as important as being good, because when you get out into the real world, your ability to go and find answers rather than create them yourselves is what it's all about. Mm-hmm. Your employer doesn't care whether you're smart, they just care that you solve that problem in a hurry. So, I would say if it doesn't kill people, getting and most of the time there's no real right answer, right? So
that's the job of UL testing.
Most of the time, the right answer is not the best answer. Like cell phones, I do not understand how you all, your generation in particular, has accepted cell phones, because I can't ever understand anything anyone's saying over a cell phone. But the engineers made a choice. Bandwidth over.
How long have you been working in speech processing now?
25 years. So I knew in the days when we used to give you good speech quality over the telephone and things like that.
And you work every day with good speech samples.
Yeah.
So, and we listen to garbage all day. So
I know, that's a problem.
We're used to this.
There was a day when audio systems on laptops were a joke compared to what we used to have in a lab. But anyway, inverse Laplace transform. So we talked last class about the fact that you really would prefer not to have to do a complex contour integration, since most of you have not had Shams and obviously don't know how to do that. So let me show you some techniques today to survive those rare instances where you have to do an inverse Laplace transform. Now, rational transfer functions, which simply means a ratio of two polynomials in S, we're going to see these a lot. We were talking earlier about what we actually use the Laplace transform for. You're going to see more and more that we're going to describe circuits and most linear systems as a ratio of polynomials, and we're going to look at stability and controllability and all these kinds of things through the eyes of this ratio of two polynomials. So we're going to focus today a little bit on what to do with how do you take the inverse Laplace transform of these things, because that's going to allow us to get impulse responses of circuits or to get outputs of circuits and that kind of thing. So we have this ratio of two polynomials, and m and n, the orders are positive integers. And whether m is greater than n or less than n is going to have a lot to do with the overall response of the system. Now, one straightforward approach to computing the inverse Laplace transform of this is to factor this thing into a sum of simpler terms whose Laplace transforms can be easily computed or looked up in a table of transform pairs. And you all know one way to do that is through the method of partial fractions expansion. So we'll spend some time today talking about how to do partial fractions expansions. And the details of this expansion really depends on the nature of this denominator polynomial. So we'll talk a little bit about that as well, whether you have repeated roots, whether you have complex roots, and things like that. Now, fortunately, MATLAB can be used to find the roots of a polynomial. And as you recall with partial fractions, going from this to this is an important step. And in MATLAB, you can actually set up the polynomial fairly simply. And so this line here sets up this polynomial, 1, 4, 6, 4. And then you call roots, and voila, you get the answer. Well, almost. The problem is, if A gets too complicated, and you won't see this in any of the textbook examples, but if you try to work real circuits with this, actually, if this is a very long polynomial, getting the roots might be a little harder. But MATLAB has a pretty good polynomial root solver in it. And it most of the time, for small polynomials, will give you a reasonable result. So we call the roots function, we get back these two complex roots, and we can then write this as a product of S plus 2, S plus, we have, it's actually, the form is S minus the root, so it's S minus the minus 2, which is S plus 2, S minus this quantity, which gives us plus 1 minus J, and plus 1 plus J. Why do we get complex conjugate roots here? Because when we started with this.
Algebra?
What?
The fundamental theorem of algebra?
Is there a fundamental theorem of algebra?
There's one called that.
Okay, you get a little bit of partial credit for that. But
what is it? The determinant
of that answer. What?
The determinant of that equation is negative or something?
No. Simpler.
Well, you're equating the square root and the quadratic equation. The inside's negative, right?
Okay, well, that's like a real engineering answer, but there's a much simpler answer. That's a good answer. But there's a simpler.
Square, right?
Simpler.
Because of the key.
Because we're dealing with.
Because there are four numbers.
Oh. Okay, you're getting warm. And what do we observe about those four numbers?
It's ordered power. It's like.
Simpler. There's four real numbers here, right? These are all real. Therefore, if you're going to have and it's a third order actually, which means we're going to have one real root and two complex conjugates because the end result has to be real. If these were not complex conjugates, when you multiply all this together, you'd be left with a complex coefficient.
Right.
So just by looking at the order of the polynomial and whether the coefficients are real or imaginary, you can tell a lot about the nature of the roots. And yes, the quadratic equation, you talk about fundamental. There, I used to give an exam question where I said, if you had one equation that you're on a desert island and no food, no water, and you're given one equation, which would it be? I used to give this in one of my classes. And the answer is the quadratic equation. It's an incredibly powerful equation. You can do so much with it. So one of the things you can do is you can break these things down into powers of two and do successive applications of the quadratic equation and all that kind of thing. But anyway, there's a lot of properties of polynomials you can look at based on whether these are real or imaginary, with the signs of them, the order of the polynomial, and all those kinds of things. Or you can just call up MATLAB or your calculator and get the answer. So let's talk about some specific examples. The first one is the easy one, when you have distinct roots. That simply means that if you have a third order polynomial, you're going to have three roots, and all three of them are different. This is the easiest case, and we can solve this using something called the method of residues, which you actually know is partial fractions expansion. So suppose there are distinct or non-repeated roots, which means none of these roots are equal to each other. Then what we can do is very simply, we can multiply by each one of these. So we can multiply by S minus P1, for example. That'll remove this term and leave the rest of these. And then we can evaluate when S is equal to P1, and we can get the value for C sub 1. And then we can repeat that for P2, and so on, repeat that for P sub N. This is called the method of residue. I think you all should be familiar with this. You've probably worked this many times before. The constant C sub I, we call those residues, and this method of computation is called the residue method. The constant C sub I is real if the corresponding pole is real. If two poles appear as complex conjugates, the C sub I must also appear in complex conjugate pairs. Because the product of those have to be real. Later, we're going to see that whether the pole is real or complex is going to have a lot to do with the frequency response and the behavior of the system. So we'll continue using this ability to factor polynomials into roots.
Once the partial fractions expansion is completed, the inverse Laplace transform can be easily found, because now all we have to do is take the inverse Laplace transform of each of these. So the inverse Laplace transform of this term is just C1 times e to the p1 times t plus C2 e to the p2 times t, and so on through Cn e to the pn times t, and for t greater than or equal to 0. Fortunately, we can also use MATLAB to find the residues, and to do that, you simply have to set up the numerator polynomial, the denominator polynomial, and then you can call a function called residue, and it will give you in R and P the poles and the residues for the partial fractions expansion. So as an exercise after class, you could actually type this example up in MATLAB and produce the result that we get. So let's go through a simple example. We have x of s is equal to s plus 2 over s cubed plus 4s squared plus 3s. Now, where did this come from? Well, this later we'll see this might actually be a circuit, could be a system, could be some kind of masses and spring system, could be, whatever. But at some point, we reduce the differential equation to a transfer function. So now we can go ahead and factor this. Well, this particular polynomial is fairly easy to factor. We can pull out an s, and then we have s squared plus 4s plus 3. We can punch in the quadratic equation, or we can be smart and just say, that's s plus 1 times s plus 3. So once we have this thing in factored form, we can now write it as a sum of three roots, c1 over s, c2 over s plus 1, c3 over s plus 3. And I think, do I have on the next slide? The
completion of those.
Yeah, okay. So we've taken x of s and we've written it as the sum of these three things. And now the question is, how do we get the values for C1, C2, C3? Well, when the roots are distinct, we can do this by simply multiplying by one of the roots. So we'll multiply by s, and then we'll evaluate what's left at s equals 0, the value of this root. That's why we call it the method of residues. We're evaluating what's left when you remove the root. And that gives us s plus 2 over s plus 1 times s plus 3 evaluated at s equals 0. If you plug that in, we have 2 over 3. So C1 is equal to 2/3. We can do the same thing for C2. We can multiply by s plus 1, which will cancel out this term, and we'll be left with s plus 2 over s times s plus 3, and we evaluate that at s equals minus 1, the value of this root, and we get minus 1 plus 2, which is 1, and we have a minus 1 here, and a 2 here, so we get minus 1 half. And then we can repeat that process for s plus 3, evaluate what's left when s is equal to minus 3, and we get minus 1 sixth. So we can take this and write this as 2/3 over s plus a minus 1 half over s plus 1 plus a minus 1 sixth over s plus 3. We can then take the inverse Laplace transform and write that the inverse Laplace transform of this is simply 2/3 times u of t, which we'll show here as t greater than or equal to 0. One of the things I want you to become comfortable with is that when you see a term like this, it corresponds to an exponential. So this term has an inverse Laplace transform of minus 1 half e to the minus t, because this is just a 1 over s plus a format, which we have in our tables, and that corresponds to an e to the minus t. And then similarly, we have a minus 1 sixth e to the minus 3t. So finding the partial fractions expansion in the case when the roots are not repeated is fairly easy, and then it's a trivial process to go from the Laplace transform, the partial fractions expansion, to the
inverse Laplace transform of the time domain signal. We can go ahead and check this in MATLAB. We can write this polynomial. We set up the numerator polynomial, the denominator polynomial, and then we can call the residue function. We get these three residues. These are the coefficients, C1, C2, C3. Actually, I take that back. This is C3, this is C2, and this is C1. The order in which they come out is just going to depend sort of on the way the root finder works, but you'll get all three roots. It just might be in different orders depending on which one it finds first. So we have 2/3 times u of t minus 1/2 e to the minus t minus 1/6 e to the minus 3t. Okay, so that's probably the easiest case that we'll run across. Three distinct and real roots. So the next step up in complexity is if we have distinct complex poles. Recall, if all the coefficients of the denominator are real, then the polynomial must have a combination of real and our complex conjugate poles, because when you multiply all these roots together, you have to get real numbers back. Which means if you have one complex number, you better have its complex conjugate. So we can factor a polynomial in this case into the form C1 over S minus P1 plus C1 conjugate over S minus P1 conjugate. This is a complex conjugate pair. That will correspond to a second order real polynomial. And then we have some additional roots. Now the inverse transform of this is interesting. One way that we could write it is simply as C1 times e to the P1t plus C1 conjugate times e to the P1 conjugate times t, where P1 and P1 conjugate are complex numbers. But we know that if you have an exponential with a complex coefficient, and if you have its complex conjugate, that pair can actually be written as 2 times the magnitude of C1 times e to the sigma t, where sigma is the real part of P1, times cosine omega, where omega is the imaginary part of P1, t, plus the angle of C1. This is just a sine wave with a frequency and a phase shift. So when we have distinct complex poles, and when they appear as complex conjugate pairs, we get a sinusoid for the output. Now, let's think about that in the complex plane, because the location of the poles in the complex plane are very important. So if we look at the example we worked previously, we had three distinct real poles. Where did they fall in this plane?
Wouldn't they be ones on the y equals 0, and then there's going to be complex conjugates in the real plane?
So let's plot these first. We have 2/3 minus 1/2 minus 1/6. Well, the two-third corresponds to a pole at what value of s?
0.
0, right. So we had a pole here.
Are they all going to be within a circle?
We had a pole here, which was minus 1/2. And we had a pole, minus 1/6 or minus 1/2, let's say.
Wouldn't that 2/3 be at 2/3 instead of 0?
No, because it corresponds to a free, it, that's a little bit, actually I messed this up. Let's do that again. Erase what I just said. Okay, where's the first pole? What value of S is the first pole at? S is equal to zero, right? Mm-hmm. What value of S is the second pole at? S is equal to minus one. And then we have S is equal to minus three. These are the three poles for that system, okay? And we see that the S equals minus one gives this term e to the minus t. Does this grow with time or shrink with time? What's the shape of this?
It shrinks,
right? So what happens if we got a pole and mine at plus one?
The system would be unstable. Like
we're going to get an e to the t term, right?
Right.
Which means that if the signal is going to grow, it will be unstable. So this imaginary axis is going to play an important role in whether the system is stable. And we'll talk about that later. Yeah, because it's whether the poles are to the left or the right of the imaginary axis. So we'll get to that. We'll talk a lot about that in a little bit. Not today, but next class. But let's come back to the complex poles. What happens when I have a complex pole and its complex conjugate? So this would be, for example, minus 1 plus j, you could say, and this would be minus 1 minus j. We saw that the combination of these give us a cosine at a particular frequency. So we will actually learn that this distance here is related to omega, the frequency of that pole. So another way to think about this is if you take a pole location here, this corresponds to an impulse response which goes like that, right? Now what happens when I move this pole in this direction and I move this pole in this direction?
There's a sinusoid on top of that response.
Exactly. Very, very good. So I'm going to get something that looks like this.
Oh, okay.
I'm going to get an e to the minus alpha t cosine omega t. That's essentially what we have here. So these complex poles actually give us a damped sinusoid type impulse response or system response. And we'll study this in more detail. But the pole locations are going to have a lot to do with what the overall structure of the signal looks like. So let's look at another example. Here we have a polynomial s squared minus 2s plus 1 over s cubed plus 3s squared plus 4s plus 2. And we can, again, we can factor this with a little bit of work help. We can write this as the product of a pole at minus 1 plus j, the complex conjugate minus 1 minus j, and then an additional real pole at minus 1. So we can factor this into this. You can multiply these out and verify that you get back that polynomial. Then we can multiply by the value of this pole, which will cancel out this term, and we'll be left with the numerator divided by these two, evaluated at minus 1 plus j, and that gives us minus 3 halves plus j2 if you work through the algebra. We can then, now, notice that we don't need to do this one, because if this value of C1 is this, we can write C1 conjugate just by changing the sign here. So then we'll go ahead and do this last pole, which is a real pole, multiplied by S plus 1, evaluated S equals minus 1, and if you evaluate this at S equals minus 1, you'll get 4. So we can write that the magnitude of C1, which is just the magnitude of this complex number, is 5/2. The angle of C1, which is just the inverse tangent of 2 divided by minus 3/2, is this angle in degrees. And we can also compute sigma, which is the real part of P1 is minus 1. That's from here. So we can write that x of t in this case must be, we can apply this formula and write 2 times the magnitude of C1 times e to the minus 1t cosine t plus this angle. Plus, then we have this additional real whole here, so we have 4 e to the minus t. So this signal corresponds to the inverse Laplace transform of this polynomial. And we see that it's, since this is a third order polynomial, we essentially have a real pole plus a cosine. And I could have just looked at that polynomial and told you that. Because it's got real coefficients, so it has to have a real pole plus a complex conjugate pair. The complex conjugate pair give you this term, and the real pole gives you this term. Okay. So the next step up in complexity is the case when you have repeated poles. What do we mean by repeated pole? Well, we mean we have a pole, plus we have that same pole raised to a power, for example, squared, and you can have multiples of those. So you could have r of them for a pole that's repeated r times. Now, this is a little more complicated, but not impossible. We're going to make use of a Laplace transform theorem, actually. But first, we can remove all of the non-repeated poles using the method of residues that we did before. So whenever there are non-repeated poles, we can remove those using the method of residues. So we don't really need to talk about that. All we really need to focus on is the residues for the repeated poles. Now, when you have a repeated pole, you have to write the partial fractions expansion as containing all powers of that pole. So if, for example, we had a repeated pole that was twice, we have to write the first order term and the second order term for that pole. And I think you've worked problems like this in calculus or something, right, when you did integration using partial fractions expansion. Do they still teach that? Or?
Yeah, they still teach that.
It's the same thing. The residues for the repeated poles, there's a sort of a nice little equation for those. The highest power coefficient or residue, you can get that by actually multiplying by the pole raised to the r power. And then once you get that coefficient, you can then compute the rest of the coefficients by multiplying by that pole to the rth power, but then differentiating what's left with respect to I. So you basically work your way down for I equals 1, 2, 3, 4, all the way up to r. If all the poles are real, the inverse can be compactly written as, we can use this recursion actually, that any time you see something of this form in your transfer function, you can map that directly to a signal, which is t to the power n minus 1 e to the minus at. This just comes about, this is a Laplace transform pair. It's also a consequence of this differentiation in the Laplace domain, which is equivalent to multiplication of the time domain by t to the power, nth power. And then repeated complex poles and complex conjugate poles can also be dealt with by combining the complex conjugate poles into one quadratic term and solving for the residues by equating terms of the polynomial. So if you have this structure, you can actually write it this way, and you can then, in fact, solve it using this kind of a structure where we solve for C and D using the method of residues rather than doing them separately. Now, you may think, well, this is all kind of mathematical nonsense, but unfortunately, when you're trying to build sharp digital filters, you'll actually put a lot of poles at the same frequency. So for really good digital filters, or analog filters actually as well, you'll have lots of repeated roots because you tend to put poles at the same frequency. And these complex conjugate pairs, you'll see these a lot in both analog and digital systems. So let's look at an example of this. Here we have a polynomial 5s minus 1 over s cubed minus 3s plus 2. So if you factor that s cubed, the denominator term, that factors into s plus 1 squared times s minus 2. But because we have the s plus 1 squared here, we have to postulate the s plus 1 term as well. So we have C1 over S plus 1 plus C1 conjugate over S plus 1 squared plus C3 over S minus 2. We can find the C1 by applying our differentiation formula, which says we multiply by S plus 1 squared times X of S, and then we differentiate that with respect to S, and then we evaluate that at S equals minus 1. So we can take this 5S minus 1, where we multiply this by s plus 1 squared, this thing goes away and we're left with the we're left with just the s minus 2. So we have 5s minus 1 over s minus 2. We differentiate this with respect to s. Well, that takes a little bit of work because we have to take the numerator times the derivative of the denominator plus the denominator times the derivative of the numerator. But the derivative of the 1 over s minus 2 is just minus 1 over s minus 2 squared. The derivative of the numerator, 5s minus 1, is just 5. And then we evaluate all that at s equals minus 1 and work through the algebra, and we're left with minus 1. C2 can be computed just by multiplying by s plus 1 squared and evaluating at s equals minus 1. And if we do that, we get 2. There's actually, this should not be C1 conjugate. I thought that was an error. This should be C2. There's no constraint that these be conjugates of each other. So we multiply by this s plus 1 squared, evaluate at s equals minus 1, and we get 2. And then we can do the real root the same way as normal. For C3, this should just be S minus 2. We multiply by S minus 2 and evaluate at S equals 2, and we get 1. So we've now got minus 1 over S plus 1 plus 2 over S plus 1 squared plus 1 over s minus 2. So the first term, the minus 1 over s plus 1, gives us a minus e to the minus t. The third term, a 1 over s minus 2, just gives us an e to the 2t. The second term, which is 2 over s plus 1 squared, we just apply our Laplace transform pair and say that that's just t e to the minus t times 2. Okay, so we've now factored a polynomial with this repeated root, repeated real roots, and we've computed the inverse transform and gotten back to the time domain. And then you can check that with MATLAB as well, and you'll get the same answer. So if the numerator has a larger order, m is greater than n, the polynomials can be decomposed into a standalone polynomial. You basically divide out the polynomials, and then we're left with a polynomial where the numerator order is lesser than or is less than the denominator order. And then the inverse transform of this term, this is going to be in powers of s. We could use our Laplace transform pair on those to write that those just correspond to various derivatives of the delta function. So if we have an x of s of this form, for example, you'll notice that the denominator, the numerator order, that should be s squared, is 1 greater than the denominator order. So we divide these out and write this as s minus 4 plus the residue, which is 20s minus 12 over this. We take the inverse Laplace transform. Well, we know how to do this now. The only question is, what is the inverse Laplace transform of these two? Well, the inverse Laplace transform of minus 4 is just minus 4 delta t. The inverse Laplace transform of s is just the derivative of delta of t. And don't ask me what that is. We'll worry about that another time. But that's in the event where you have a numerator which has a higher order than a denominator, you can in fact produce the inverse Laplace transform. And this long division can actually be computed using a function in MATLAB called decomp. So you don't have to do that by hand. Now, the pole locations, as we talked about here, determine the behavior of the signal. We've seen that the structure of the poles in the denominator polynomial play a significant role in determining the structure of the signal. If it's a distinct real pole, it produces an exponential term. If it's a repeated pole, it produces this exponential plus t times that same exponential. If it's a complex conjugate pole, it produces this damped sinusoid. If it's a repeated complex conjugate pole, you get essentially a damped sinusoid plus t times a damped sinusoid and potentially higher powers of t depending on how much it's repeated. As a result, the signal can be determined directly from the poles. Modifying the numerator does not change the signal significantly. It just changes the value of these weights or constants associated with the signal. Further, we can observe that x of t converges to zero as t goes to infinity if and only if the poles of the signal have real parts which are strictly less than zero. We need this term, we need the value of p here to be negative, to have a negative real part, for this thing to go to zero. So, x of t, the amplitude of x of t will only go to zero as t goes to infinity if the poles are located in what we call the left half plane. So the poles will play a critical role in the stability of a system. The field of control systems deals with stability issues in signals and systems. So if you've watched something like the Science Channel or this show about how they build big structures, you may have noticed that a lot of structures today use active control systems. For example, these really high skyscrapers that they're building, when they're built in earthquake zones, have at the very, I don't know if you've ever seen these programs, it's really cool, they have at the very top of them a big weight. What is that big weight? Well, they actually fill a big drum with water. And they actually then move these weights, water or sometimes as actual weights, to when the building starts vibrating, they move these weights to offset the building vibration so that the building will actually stay straighter. And this is done all in, this is done in real time. And they do that kind of thing using the very kind of analysis we're talking about. Those damping weights try to stabilize the building by trying to offset the resonant frequencies of these poles. And they actually measure the vibration of the building in real time and then create a system that tries to offset that by moving the weight in the opposite direction. That's one simple example.
If you're into cars and you know anything about modern race cars have all sorts of controllers on them that are tweaked for various conditions of the racetrack and things, and there's a lot of technology that goes into the difference between often a winning car and a losing car in a stock car or IndyCar type racing is essentially how much the crew can adjust the car during the race to optimize it for the conditions. The cars are pretty much all the same, other than the ability for the crews to tune them at race time. And if they tune them the day before the race, the conditions during the race are different. They'll actually end up with the worst setup. So they're constantly during the race actually tuning the performance of the car. It's pretty amazing how much they do. And they actually now have monitors on the cars that transmit all sorts of information about the performance of the engine. And all this is done in real time. And it's all done using this kind of analysis. If X of S has a single pole at S equals zero, the limiting value of X of T is equal to the residue corresponding to that pole. This is actually an application of the final value theorem. So if you see these single poles at S equals zero, that also tells you something about the long-term behavior of the signal. Now, the other kind of transform that we have to deal with are ones containing exponentials. That might look something like this. You might have a ratio of two polynomials times some exponential term, which is a function of S. The function is not rational in S, and we refer to these things as transcendental functions of S. Most of the time, you'll only see e to the minus s, and later in the course we'll see why that is. You won't see typically like sine of s or cosine of s or those kinds of things, but you will see exponentials. And our approach to computing the inverse transforms in this case is to simply apply the time shift property, because we know that this term translates to a time shift. So all we really have to do is to take the inverse transform of this and then apply the time shift to it. Now, these functions arise when we have Laplace transforms of piecewise continuous signals, like this pulse that we have here. The inverse Laplace transform of this is 1 over s minus 1 over s e to the minus c times s. So if you have a transform like this, you sort of know that you're going to have to apply the time shift theorem to get back the original signal. You'll have the signal and then a time shifted version of itself. So here we have an example of a kind of nasty looking Laplace transform. And we know how to deal with this term because it's just the ratio of two polynomials. But these two terms have these exponentials. So what we can do, one way to tackle this would be to compute the inverse Laplace transform of this and then apply a time shift. We can compute the inverse Laplace transform of this and then apply a time shift. But we can also observe that this form is actually listed in your transform tables and has an inverse Laplace transform that looks like this. This form can be written as cosine t plus 2 sine t. Again, you have a transform table for that. And then we have, for this term, we know that the inverse transform of this is e to the minus t, but because we have the delay, we have e to the minus quantity t minus 1, u of t minus 1. So we apply a time shift here, and then we similarly apply a time shift here to get this. So when we see these exponentials, we know we just have to use the time shift theorem. So what we've done today is to go through most of the cases that you'll encounter when you have to do inverse Laplace transforms. And the technique is pretty simple. We factor the denominator. We assess the complexity of the poles. We compute the coefficients using a method of residues, and with applying the specific techniques for the different types of poles, and then we're able to write the inverse Laplace transform by inspection.
We also discussed the influence the poles have on the resulting signal, and we'll study this more carefully later in the course. And then finally, we can use the MATLAB symbolic toolbox. You can actually write the polynomials in S and get the inverse Laplace transform automatically. So you might say, well, why did you just waste 50 minutes of my time? But unfortunately, this doesn't always converge, like on final exams. So I gave it last semester, I gave a final exam, and they had trouble actually getting it to work, and they kind of panicked. But there were other ways they could work the problem. Okay, so I will see you, what is today?
Monday.
Okay, so I'll see you on Wednesday. I don't, things go so fast, I don't
know. I mean,
is it June? Yeah.
I can't believe we're not past the first time. I wish we were still in the first few weeks.